Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
How to have fun. Anytime. Anywhere. Step one. Go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two. Collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three. Play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games. All for free?
Step four. Unleash your excitement.
Chumba. Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Hidden Killers Year in Review. A look back at the biggest stories of 2025. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Let's move over to the Gilgo Beach murders. One of the cases that never was leaving the public's imagination, and also sets the remain 11 sets rather of remains found along Ocean Parkway. Families waiting years for answers, and a suspect who seemed to live in plain sight. Rex Huerman, Long Island architect, now stands accused of killing seven women between 1993 and 2011. This week, the judge ruled that all seven charges will be tied together, a decision that could shape the entire outcome of the case. Eric Faddis, obviously, you are here to help us break this down. That ruling that they made this week, for more than a year, the defense fought to sever that sprawling case into several different cases, arguing each murder was too different to be lumped together. But the judge, Timothy Mazie, ruled that the murders are inextricably interwoven, and prosecutors will get to present them as one long pattern instead of seven small battles. There's now one giant war. It's more than a technicality. It changes how jurors will experience the case. They won't see a collection of isolated deaths. They'll hear the state's theory of a single predator operating across decades and a pattern of behavior. What is this ruling? How does this reshape the entire trial before a jury is even seated, before we even have a court date, really?
I think it's a huge ruling, and I think it's going to be really problematic for the defense because, you know, when a jury hears about one alleged murder, they're already getting shivers. I mean, it's already an uncomfortable situation to be in, and you start looking sideways at the accused. Did he do it? Could he have done this? But when you hear about multiple alleged murders with a lot of similarities between them, you know, you look at the type of alleged victim. They were all sex workers. You look at the locale. Most of them were located within a specific locale, their bodies. There are overlap in terms of the evidence among the murders, including vehicles used and including DNA evidence as well. And so, you know, as defense, it's hard to say, hey, my guy didn't do any of these multiple murders. It's just a huge conspiracy. Well, why, you know, person being charged with like 11 murders or so automatically has a huge disadvantage on the defense side, way harder than defending a single murder.
Because at the end of the day, in this case, it's not an all or nothing verdict that's going to come in. They're going to look at all of these charges, are they not, for each individual crime. The jury, correct me if I'm wrong, they could in theory come back and say, well, we think you're guilty of this one, and this one, but not that one, this one, and the one over here.
Oh, they absolutely could. And that'll be the jury's responsibility. They will have to determine each individual charge. And I bet defense is going to request a limiting instruction, which is where the judge says to the jury, hey, if you find evidence of murder one, that the number one count, that doesn't mean you can use that evidence in and of itself to convict him of the second count of murder. However, jurors are human beings, and I think they're going to look at this in a more holistic fashion, which is a problem for the defense, but could give the defense some kind of out on appeal should there be a conviction.
Jurors are human beings, and so are the victims here, obviously, in this. Unfortunately, our society doesn't feel that way half the time about sex workers. And clearly, whoever killed these people did not look at them as human beings as well. Is this... I totally understand the argument of this could easily get a conviction and weigh it stronger for the prosecution, but does it denigrate or lessen the value of the lives of these victims by lumping them all into one big pile of sex workers?
It's an important question because you got to look at this from the perspective of the victims' families. You know, if you have one trial where they're trying to convict somebody of killing your loved one, that's sort of center stage. Your loved one's memory is going to be center stage as well. But when you have multiple alleged victims, there's a concern that things can kind of get lost in this murky murder soup, which is a horrible thing to think about. But, you know, and also, does the prosecution spend more time on perhaps the stronger charges and perhaps kind of call in the less stronger charges? You have that concern when there is a trial that involves so many alleged acts over the course of the better part of two decades.
And I want to stress this because the similarities in these victims' deaths were not all identical. And that's where I was a little, I don't want to say surprised, but I just didn't know where it was going to go with the judge's decision this week. The defense argued that the cases had nothing in common. The first victim from 1993 stabbed, others strangled, some dismembered, some wrapped in burlap. And obviously we know the burlap ones had hairs of the Huerman family on them, pretty much all of them. And the timeline stretched almost 20 years. I mean, their position was that there was no true signature, and putting them together would unfairly prejudice a jury. They even floated five separate trials to keep things more isolated. Obviously, they lost that motion. Again, I do think, in my opinion, I think Rex has a lot to do with this. But again, I'm looking at this going, are they jumping the gun on trying to connect all this stuff? And will it backfire in the end? Because I feel like the defense, I feel like in some ways, this gave the defense some pretty strong arguments of the differences in all of these cases. And they better have pretty strong evidence on each and every single one of these murders that ties it to Rex, not just some collective, well, it looks like it kind of could have. I mean, the hairs on the burlap ones are certain, but I don't know about the others. Are they tying some of these in here to stronger pieces because it will make that case stronger rather than being tried on its own?
100%. I think that's absolutely the approach the prosecution is taking. And you're right. It gives rise to this concern that when the jury's looking at this case back in the deliberation room and they're saying, hey, I think there's enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of the first murder and the second murder. Well, I'm not so sure, but let's err on the side of caution and convict him of that anyway. Well, that presents a tremendous fairness issue. It presents a tremendous due process issue and significant appellate issues as well. You got to be careful of overplaying your hand. Yes, Daisy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. No, but isn't there a bit of public pressure that they want him to be guilty of all of these? So if he's guilty of one, we kind of need to blanket it, because if we don't, there's another serial killer out there who could still be loose. Isn't this more for public pressure?
It's a critical point, and it's something, if I was defense counsel, I'd be arguing during closing, saying that, hey, look, the government has all of these dead bodies, and they can't solve those cases.
Right.
But here we have this scapegoat, and you know, we think they think they can tie him to a handful of misdeeds. And so let's add on all of our unsolved stuff to make us look like heroes and say, hey, we got the guy, we got him, you know, and we solved all these murders from decades ago, when really they better come with the evidence if they're going to take that approach, because simply insinuation does give rise to the specter that they're just trying to get some homicide cases off their desk and sort of look like the hero.
That's what it feels like, honestly. And in no way am I trying to like downplay Rex Huerman. I think he's certainly tied to some of these without a doubt. And if you were just to look at some of the others ago, I mean, that's a probability. But then you also take into account the sheer population in that area of the country, New York, Long Island, all that. You have more people condensed in one little spot than most any other place in the United States. You have a lot of people, a lot of death, a lot of murder around there just because of having that many people there. And it's not uncommon that there are deaths and murders on that seedy side of the world. People don't like BS. People don't like being lied to. People don't like cops trying to spin a story to fit their narrative, which we've already seen in this, or I guess lack of action in this case for quite some time, why it took forever to actually get to a conviction in this case, or a charge in this case. I'm looking at this and I'm feeling like they're going about this the wrong way. I feel like you could very easily get a jury, because you could just as easily get a jury in this that's going to go, we think you're stretching the limits over here quite a bit, so why should we believe anything you're saying over here?
Oh, totally. So the prosecution's credibility is super important with this jury. If they overextend, if they overplay their hand, like you said, it could call into question how a jury sees the reliability of the rest of their evidence. And if I'm defense counsel, perhaps I'm arguing something like, you know, this case is about overkill, but it's not my client's overkill. It's the government who is trying to pin on the scapegoat all of these additional charges that they couldn't solve otherwise. And if you can't, you know, place any faith in those accusations, how much faith can you really place in what the government sees as some more solid accusations?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, look, he's guilty. In my opinion, he's guilty of several of these. Is he guilty of all of them? We don't know. But there's obviously there are several other cases that they have not tied to him yet that are just sitting out there kind of in speculation. Will they add this? Won't they add this? And may end up being tied to this at the end of the day, but it seems like a very tightrope that they have to be walking on right now, especially as this leads up to trial too. We still don't have a trial date. We don't even know when this trial will take place. In your opinion, what would you think? Next year at some point? Or, I mean, could this play out for several more years with the possibility of them throwing more victims onto this?
You know, I'm hopeful that we'll reach some kind of finality in 2026. That being said, you know, one single murder case can be pushed out for months, if not years. We're talking multiple murder cases all combined into one. And on top of that, if they add charges, if they add alleged victims, that can start the whole thing over again because the defense has to investigate a brand new murder case. And so we might not see any resolution for these victims' families and for Rex until 2027 or possibly beyond.
So what is the definition of a speedy trial then? Because not that I'm defending Rex Huerman, but how long can somebody remain behind bars without their trial taking place?
It's a very important question. It comes up a lot, Stacey. So typically there is what's called a statutory right to speedy trial, which is in the state's law. And then there's a constitutional right to speedy trial. Statutory right to speedy trial is usually something like 6 months, but there are exceptions. And sometimes the defense agrees to waive it. In fact, commonly the defense would agree to waive their statutory right to speedy trial to do additional investigation, get prepared for trial. The constitutional one is much more vague and unclear. It's kind of like within a reasonable amount of time, and you look at other cases and say, hey, it's been longer than this case, but less long than this case. Does that result in a constitutional violation? So certainly that could come into play as we approach 2026. And if it goes longer than that, certainly we're having concerns about speedy trial at that point. But there's usually not a great black and white rule for that, except on the statutory side, which has a ton of exceptions.
Gotcha. Thank you.
On the tightrope that they're walking here, the forensics are on the front line here. The DNA, sequencing and the process that they're using is unlike anything most jurors have seen. Investigators used whole genome sequencing. Of course, we all know what that is, right? It's a first in New York murder trials. It is a reliable science. It's just a new science. And when anything is new, people are going to have questions. To match degraded hairs from multiple victims to Huerman. They also say they found female hairs belonging to his wife on some of the victims, even though she was out of town at the time of the murder, suggesting transfer from basically the Huerman household. And Huerman, Rex, from the house to Rex to the bodies to the burlap sacks. The defense calls it magic science. And obviously it's not magic science. It's creative use of words. They're trying to make it sound like this is junk science.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The evidence is going to be a big fulcrum of this entire case. And again, it's a tightrope. You're combining all these cases into one. You're using a new type of technology that hasn't been used in a New York court case before. Is that going to present some issues? How receptive are juries to hearing evidence from, you know, a new way of examining DNA? It's already confusing as it is.
It very much is. You know, jurors often look at experts, at least initially, as having significant authority in that field, just being deemed an expert by the judge and being allowed to testify at trial. There's some credibility that might be imputed because of that from the jury to the expert. That being said, certainly defense is going to find some expert in DNA sciences who says, hey, this is too new. It's not reliable. You can't, you know, bet on it and hang your hat on it for convicting a person of murder. And they'll find an expert who will say that. I very much anticipate. It's going to be a battle in there, and the prosecution is going to have to do a good job of explaining exactly what this is and why it should be reliable, and especially based on how new it is.
Well, and obviously every technology has its first day in court. This will be the first time, supposedly, in New York for this to be tested out. Could this trial set precedent for future cases and how advanced DNA is used in future prosecutions nationwide, especially if they do get a conviction on it, seeing it worked over here? Let's use it more over here.
100%, it could have a cascading effect throughout the country in that fashion, because one of the main factors that a court looks at in deciding whether to allow expert testimony is, hey, did another judge do it? Did they think it was good enough? Did they think it was sufficient? And if so, I feel reasonably comfortable with admitting such evidence in my case as the judge. And so, it's definitely going to have a significant effect. I think this is going to be used in jurisdictions across the country, assuming it's successful. If it's not successful, or if it is severely weakened during trial, I think law enforcement's going to have to take a second look at that.
We know that Asa Elrup from his wife or ex-wife now, but from what we understand in the documentary that we recently watched, they got divorced more so for financial reasons to protect assets and things of that nature. Okay, great. That happens all the time. But you're no longer married to him. Is there spousal rights here when this comes to testifying, when this comes to being interviewed by police, when it comes to any of that? There's, you know, certainly plead the fifth type motions, but what sort of protections does Asa have going forward in this now that they are no longer married?
You know, if she had any involvement, which I'm not saying she did at all, but if she did, one protection is the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination and the privilege to not incriminate oneself at trial. But when it comes to spousal privilege, that gets more murky, especially when the union has dissolved. So Rex Huerman likely will not be able to raise some kind of spousal privilege argument to prevent her from testifying entirely. It usually applies to communications that are supposed to be confidential with your spouse. And the idea behind it is that we don't want to break up families by having one spouse testify against the other at trial. Well, families already broken up. So that policy and the rationale behind the privilege doesn't really apply to this upcoming trial.
And she doesn't seem to be that she'd be opposing witness for Rex. I wonder if, I mean, could she be called by the defense to help back up Rex and being the good old family man that he is, according to her in the documentary?
Yes. So in this context, if there is any spousal privilege under state law, it would rest with Rex. And he could always waive that privilege and call to his wife to testify. And she likely wouldn't have like her own privilege to assert. It would be the defendant who could assert it or not. So if she's going to give favorable testimony, certainly defense could call her, and they might do so in sort of an unexpected way. Perhaps they sort of posture as if, hey, you're not going to hear from the wife, whatever. And then she's the surprise witness who does some who scores some points for the defense. That's happened before.
Judging by what we saw in that documentary, do you think she would be an effective witness for him?
She could have some favorable things to say about him. That being said, on cross-examination, the prosecutor is going to talk about that residence, and they're going to talk about what was found in there. And they're going to talk about, you mean to tell me that he never told you about the, over a dozen times that he was allegedly engaged in criminal activity. You had no clue whatsoever. They could really try to impugn her credibility up there. And so it could be a big risk calling her for the defense.
Well, and she also appears a little bit like a victim. Well, a lot like a victim. Mm-hmm. And to find all this sexually deviant stuff in the house, which, if you've got some kinks, that's your deal, fine. But we're looking at murder investigation here. And some of the things that were found, how did she not know about this?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a big question, a line of questioning from the prosecutor if she testifies. Because, look, I mean, most people know their spouses reasonably well. Certainly some secrets can be hidden. But there was a lot that was taken from that house. There's a good amount of digital material as well. And so it could make her look pretty bad, and also could, if she did have some knowledge and had some kind of involvement, which I'm not saying she did, but if she did, and if that comes out in trial, she could be in hot water too. So there's a lot of risks that abound with calling a spousal witness like that.
You know, we just saw the Adelson trial, and obviously we saw one of the Adelson children who lives in upstate New York testify basically against mom, against Donna. When we saw in that documentary about Huerman recently was the daughter, and she didn't flat out say she thinks he did it, but she seems to be coming to terms with the idea that he probably did do it. And that's my conjecture on it. I think most people got that out of the documentary, that she's kind of coming there and mom's not seeing it at all. Asa's not seeing it. What could happen here with the daughter? Could the daughter end up testifying? Could she be compelled to testify? Could she plead the fifth? I mean, could they go back and play the clips from the documentary where she's basically incriminating her father?
Yes. So the way that they would do it, she does not have any sort of daughter parent privilege. There's no such thing exists.
Sure.
She likely doesn't have a Fifth Amendment privilege unless she had some kind of involvement, which there's no indication she did. And so what happens is they would call her and as a witness, the prosecution would say, hey, did you ever say this about your dad? And she can either admit to it on the stand and say, yeah, I said that something that sounds incriminating. Or she could say, no, I never said that. And they'll say, hey, let's go to the tape. And we saw that in the Karen Reed case a lot in sort of a little different fashion. But
sure.
Those clips can be central to either side's case. And here, more likely the prosecution.
Yeah. And I would imagine there's a treasure trove of that information. Do you think, that's just what we saw on the finished product of the documentary. As we saw in the Karen Reed case, there's a lot on the cutting room floor. They could they subpoena that sort of information from the media entity, the G-Unit Productions, 50 Cent Group that made the doc?
They certainly can subpoena it. Now, sometimes there are protections that arise for media outlets, but usually those protections just prevent calling the specific reporters as witnesses. Mm-hmm. There are ways to sidestep those, including subpoenaing materials, content, films, that kind of thing, to which such a privilege usually doesn't apply. So I don't think the defense is going to be shielded by any of those sort of media protections here. And the cutting room floor stuff is sometimes where the gold is at.
I bet there is. I bet it is. It's like Scrooge McDuck's gold broom, where he dives in at the beginning of DuckTales. You know what we're all talking about? DuckTales. Woo! Woo-hoo. There we go. Got a little DuckTales in. I would imagine there's a lot of it there. One more question. How the hell do you get an impartial jury on this one? I mean, where do you move this thing to? Because it's New York, it's Long Island. Everybody in this general vicinity with all of these people know about this case and know it well. It's been a trauma, I would say, to the population as a whole for many people for decades. What do you do?
Oh, totally. It's a huge quagmire for defense because so many reasons. So many people know about these allegations in New York against Rex Hurlman, tying him to multiple alleged murders. That's a huge problem. On top of that, like you said, the communities themselves have likely been impacted by these series of events, these sex workers who go missing, these bodies that are found within their communities, that they can be scared. Perhaps they have relatives who might have engaged in sex work at some point in their lives. And all of those personal connections to this case can really make it difficult for the defense to get a fair shake once we get to the trial phase. And so those will certainly be arguments if there's a conviction that'll be raised on appeal. But, you know, do you send it to upstate New York and hope it's rural and detached enough? Even then, I'm not sure you're in a great spot.
I don't know how you get around that in this one. That's going to be very, and if you have jurors that have no clue what the hell's going on with this, do you want them as jurors?
Right.
Like to be that disconnected from where, can they have it like in an Amish community or something in upstate New York?
I was wondering if they would defense would try to move it to somewhere like that. I've never seen that, but a creative idea.
Yeah. The Quakers will decide the future of Rex Hurlman. It's a fascinating case. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into these cases. Always so much appreciated. That's going to wrap up today's episode of Hidden Killers Live. Tomorrow, we're going to dive into probably more in the David case. We're going to take a look at some of the videos, some of those pieces of evidence that exist, or just pieces of media, pieces of his art, pieces of his work that look pretty damn incriminating. We'll take a look at that. Plus, we're going to also dive into newly released footage of the surviving roommates in the Brian Koberger Idaho 4 murder case. Their testimony, what they had said to police immediately after the killings took place. We're going to dissect some of that and dig into it. And let me say this, in no way are we looking at them as any sort of guilt or suspect, or because there's people out there that do that shit. We're not doing it. We're just going to take a look at those the questions that were asked and what was the mindset, and really I think we're going to examine the psychological end of it, the trauma that going through something like this implants into young minds that have to endure it. So that'll be tomorrow, 10 a.m. Central on our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Search it, press subscribe if you're there right now, so you don't miss any of that. And be sure to let us know what your thoughts are on this case and all the cases we've talked about in the comment section on the video. Until next time, for Eric, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.